Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. I'm J.D. Holliday, and welcome to A Good Story is a Good Story, a special edition with your host, Marcia Casper-Cook, here on BTR's World of Ink Network. Be prepared to call in and chat with our special guest today, author Jack Remick. It's 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on July 20th, 2012. A Good Story is a Good Story. It can be listened to live at blogtalkradio.com/worldofinknetwork. Or you can listen to it on demand at any time you like at the same address or on iTunes by researching World of Ink Network. As I mentioned, we'll be taking your calls towards the end of the show. And if you'd like to call in and ask a question, the phone number is 714-242-5259. That's 714-242-5259. Or join us here in the chat room at Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon, Marcia.
Hi, who are you, JD? How are you doing?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm good. I just want to say thank you to Blog Talk Radio because they have been featuring us, and we have had thousands and thousands of new people listening this week. And that started with your show on Saturday, and I just want you to talk about your show for a few seconds. But your show, I think they started featuring us Saturday and continued on the whole week. And you want to just say what you do on your show a little? Because your show, you had, like, sure. I think, like 37,000 people listening. So, I mean, you did, it's a really,
you.
Which you did not expect, I know.
No, okay. We did not expect that. But I want to just say my show is called It's Storytime, Gather Round, with myself, J.D. Holliday, and my co-host is Christy Condaleo. And we read children's books. And we read, sometimes we read just one book, and sometimes we read two. And then we get out, and then if you want, you can hear it later on, at like just like this show, you can hear it on demand. And it's on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. Thanks, Marcia.
You know what the interesting thing is? I think people don't realize one thing, that you can listen if you're in your car, or you don't have to be on a computer. You can just call in the number, which is 714-242-5259, and just listen. I mean, I listen to the show sometimes, and I know that I sometimes Fran Lewis is on a show, and then she'll say, "Marcia, are you there?" I'm not on the computer. I'm just listening. But it's really kind of good to do that, because this way you don't have to be in one particular spot. So, which is
right.
Kind of like my life, you know. So the number again is 714-242-5259, and all of the shows of World of Ink, you know, you can listen to always on demand and iTunes, and so and there's a lot of links out there. I mean, on all of our sites and worldofinknetwork.com. So you can always find our shows out there, and you can call into the shows if you want to talk. Also, let's see, you have a show tomorrow. Virginia has a show on Monday. And
right.
I think her show is at, I put it out here. She's got, I wrote it down. Let's see. It's a young adult author, and it's the time so far, I think it's 2 o'clock is her time, that she usually, 2 o'clock Eastern, and I think it's 1 o'clock. I will find that out for you, because I did write it out, but I have a lot of notes here, and I never use them anyway, and that's why I always, every time I put the notes out, I do this. Well, the young adult author is Dominic Domingo, and that will be on Monday. And I don't think I'll have a show on Tuesday, but as we know, I might. I sometimes decide to do a show in like a day. And also, I just would like to say one thing today about the Aurora shooting in Colorado. I'm really so sorry that this happened, and I know everybody listening is very sorry about this, and I hope that someday these things will not happen. I mean, people there were just going to a movie, which is what we all love. And somehow I heard on the news today it takes away when people are at a movie now, they have to worry, and that's really a shame, because a movie you're supposed to have a good time in, not worry. So I'm so sorry for everybody that is gone and injured, so we think about them when we're doing the show. And now we're just going to have our regular show and try to make people have a good time, because when the news started this morning, everybody heard it early. And we have a wonderful guest, Jack Remick, who is terrific. Joanne Buchanan had him on her show, and I heard him. He's wonderful. He talks about everything. I mean, and he'll introduce himself, because there's so many things. It's good, because between the two of us, we could probably talk for 5 hours straight. Hi, Jack. How are you? Jack?
Hi, Jack.
We probably lost him. Here he is. Okay, wait a minute. I'm going to bring him back in. Jack, we lost you. I'm talking about you, and I lost you.
Oh, you lost me. Well, that's good. I'm a lost soul anyway. I'm a lost boy.
No, you're
it works
not.
Out
I was just talking about the show, and then I also said that you and I can talk for probably 5 hours straight about all the things that we want. And I want you to just tell people a few things that you do. You do so many things, but you'll try to fit them all in. But we're going to talk about a lot of subjects today, so that's a good thing.
Sounds good to me. Yeah.
Well, how do you want to start of who you are? Tell what you want to
be
known
for. Well,
all
right. Well, okay. What I am, I'm a writer. I'm a novelist, a poet, a screenwriter, short story writer. Been around for quite a while. I have a whole bunch of books out. The latest set is something called the California Quartet from a house here in Seattle called Coffeetown Press. I have two outlier novels, one called Blood and the other called Gabriela and the Widow, which is coming in November 1st of this year. I've had, poems and stories printed and everywhere. Those kinds of things were sort of primers for what I really wanted to do as a writer, which was to sort of fix in time and space certain experiences I had had without writing in a completely autobiographical way. I've had a couple screenplays placed in contests. I haven't made any money on the screenplays yet, but
well, that would
know,
be
I've
most
written...
people. That would be that's the cry out there. That is most people, and they don't understand how hard it is to make money as a screenwriter.
Yeah, that's one of the hardest things. One writer that I worked with teaching this whole thing, he said, if I told my students how hard it is to be a screenwriter, they wouldn't want to do it. And so I did some research and looked at this about the number of what they call spec scripts that are written in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a standing joke when your waiter comes to your table in Hollywood,
right,
asking how he's coming on his screenplay. Everybody's writing his screenplay.
Everybody there is, I know.
Yeah,
everybody's writing
a
screenplay everywhere. A lot of people now, a lot. It's a huge, because I think especially people out of work, and a lot of them think they're actually going to get this done right away. And it could be 10 years before anybody even looks at it. But
exactly.
I still do it. Listen, I have 11 or 12 screenplays. I love screenwriting. I have options. I've gotten paid for some of the options now. But the thing is that I love it. I love writing a screenplay. And those of us that really do love it, we just love it. And, not everybody wants to do it. I'm not a descript writer as I thought I was. And that's why I went into screenwriting. And now I'm getting to be more descript. But I think screenwriting has helped me really see the picture.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because I worked with a couple other writers, and we had this idea that write your novel and then turn it into a screenplay and then rewrite your novel based on your screenplay.
Right.
A lot of people don't think to do that, but what happens if you do that is you tighten everything up, your dialogue gets better, you become more adept at handling the settings and the notations and things like that. Turns into a better novel if you go that way. But most people think of, adapting the novel to the screenplay and letting it go.
Yep.
But they don't see writing the screenplay not necessarily as a product that you're going to try to produce or get made into a movie, but as a tool for helping you rewrite your novel to make it more action-filled, more dynamic, the dialogue stronger, those kinds of things. So it's a technique we use a lot. We've developed out of that a technique that we call cut two, for example. Take your entire novel and take each scene and treat it as though it were a separate scene. And so you say, my story opens, cut to the next scene. And in that scene, cut to. Do that for all the way through your novel. And first thing you know, you see all the extraneous stuff you have, all the overwritten stuff you have, all the terrible dialogue, and you realize, now I know how to write my novel.
Right.
So it's a really good process. But so many writers want to write that novel, write the screenplay, and sell it. And just to backtrack one more time, use it as a rewriting tool, and the world opens up to you as a writer. So
I think that's true, because it gets tighter, it gets better. And, you know, and I, for me, a lot of times when I know, you know, when I read it out loud, then you can really see how the dialogue, if it's good or not, because it, when you write it, it's not the same as listening to it. It's just,
it's a whole different
ballgame.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we learned in that process was do all everything first and add dialogue last, because in the screenplay it seems that dialogue is not necessarily about telling the story but about revealing character.
Right.
And so you want to get those dialogue lines that reveal character and subtext, let the action advance the story. And if you learn that as a novelist, wow, suddenly your writing starts to become very, very straightforward and dynamic, instead of getting lost in these kinds of internal things that novelists tend to do. Because it's impossible to film a thought unless you do it in a flashback. I mean, how do you film thinking, you know? It's impossible. So that teaches you a lesson as a writer.
I think it does a lot. I think, really, since I've done my screenwriting, I can I see the picture, you know. I think some people think they see the picture, but they don't really see the picture because they're so worried about every word that they use, and they're trying to use a language that people don't really talk in. You have to go from how people really live their lives and how they talk.
Yeah.
They don't talk like a book.
Yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. Well, Raymond Chandler used to say, or he wrote a series of essays and stories called Pick Up on Noon Street. And I think it's called The Gentle Art of Murder is the book of essays. And he says, dialogue in the novel should give the illusion of being a conversation. But if you listen to the way people talk, most of the time it's full of false starts and hems and haws and, you know, going off here and coming back there. There's no directness in conversation. Unless you're talking to a college professor, sometimes they can, you know, like I'm doing right now. I'm jumping all over the place. You know?
No, you're not. See, I can follow that. Believe me, trust me, that's my life. I can follow that. My husband, when he's trying to follow me, he goes, "Now, what conversation were you in?"
Yeah, what are we talking about here? Exactly.
I can do five conversations at the same time because I'm used to writing for. I do write scripts with a lot of people in it, and you know, and so I do talk for a lot of people, which I guess works out some way. But the thing is that when you're talking to a person, sometimes they don't know what you're thinking inside.
Well, that's why the importance of realizing in novel and in screenplay, the function of the dialogue is, again, not to tell the story, but to reveal character. And if you realize that, then you get away from what we call armored prose, which is saying things in the standard way. So, for instance, if you have a character who says, you know, I go to the store every day, you know, that's kind of generic, you know. That if the guy says, you know, I pick up beans and rice, you know, at the market on Fridays, you know, that's a totally different thing than it is when you just use the generic language. Yeah. And that's one point that we try to stress in my writing and when I work with other writers is don't use the generic language to reveal character. You have to find language that is character.
Yeah.
And so it's a very difficult process. It's time-consuming. But when you achieve that final point of realizing it's the character speaking and not you putting words in their mouth, then you start to see how writing really does work.
You know, it's funny that you said that because I'll tell you, I in my newest, you know, short story, my Sexy Lunch, it's like a half. It's like 28 pages, and it's going to be three of them.
Sexy one, Sexy La Marcia. Come on.
Sexy, right? Okay.
It's more
sexy
than
lunch
sexy.
Time. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. So this is what's interesting. My character Virginia Templeton, I wrote her like 12 years ago, and then I wrote her in this story. I've never written a short. This is my first short story. I've never written one. I always write either scripts or books or whatever. And so when I reread the script after I wrote the story, and I went like, oh my God, she said the same things. I mean, it was so weird because, you know, I think when you're writing a character, like you just said, that is who Virginia Templeton is. It took me as a writer a very long time to remember that it's not me speaking, it's Virginia speaking. And so when I learned that, that's how she talks, not how I would talk.
Well, your Virginia character is very important for me because what I see is she takes control of her life. She's using language to empower herself to move through her relationships. She's no longer afraid. And so you see in that Virginia character the power of language to liberate, which is kind of what I'd kind of like to talk about some on this show is, you know, how we use language to hide what we're actually thinking and how we use that same masking to keep our characters from saying what they really mean. So when she shows up, is it, I've forgotten the guy's name, she shows up at the apartment door, she's drunk, she pounds on the door, and she wants in, and she says, I want to get laid right now.
Right.
I mean, yeah, this is a woman saying what she wants at that moment. And instead of, you know, saying, open the door, I want to talk to you, you know, she gets right to the, you know, gets right to the point, and that reveals her character. So I think you did a good job presenting her.
You know, it's very interesting because I wasn't going to send it to you. I thought, like, I don't know, can I do this? I can send it.
Well,
it is, you know,
yeah,
it's hard sometimes.
I'm working with a writer right now. Her name is Sarah Martinez. It's her first novel, but she has written this interesting book called Sex and Death in the American Novel. And, of course, that's a take on Leslie Fiedler's notion of love and death in the American novel. And she, you know, has been really sort of on the attack front of this approach to using language in its full capacity and not masking, not using the euphemisms of, you know, Victorian, you know, anti or quasi pornography. Like, I got this one line that comes in her book. It's the mother character speaking to her, and she says, "You've been writing for a while now, Viviana. Don't you think it's time to move past this need to write so explicitly about something most people don't really want to read about?"
Yeah.
You know, well,
well, because
that sort
of
lays it on the line.
Yeah, you know, it is hard for people to do that. I think sometimes because people, they don't really want – that is a problem for most people. They don't really – if they really said what they were going to say, they probably would have no friends. Sometimes people really want to say a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that I confront all the time is the writers need to be loved.
Yeah.
And we want the people to like us. We want people to read our books. We want people to say, "Oh, how wonderful!" You know, well, they're kind of what I call safe writing and safe reading in this whole universe. Most writers wind up imitating themselves. Let me just throw an aside in here again, using language in that way. You write screenplays, you write children's books, you write erotica, you write novels, you see. So this is a broad range of commitment to the craft and to the, you know, to the art. What that's telling me is you're as interested in the writing and in the producing of the good sentence and the good story as you are in being loved as a writer, see. Most of us really will sacrifice our good writing in order to be loved. And that's because, in my view, what happens is most readers want to read safe. They don't want to be taken to the edge and dropped over. They want to have a real safe environment where they can sit back and get inside the story. Well, what happens then is the writer writes to that, and so everything sounds the same. I have written a book with Bob Ray called The Weekly Novelist Writes a Mystery. In the process of writing that book, I must have read 1,000 mysteries to look for patterns. And after a while, the patterns start to reveal themselves. It became clear to me that that's what readers want. They want the same thing over and over and over. It's kind of a reassurance of some kind. I haven't quite figured that out. But it's the safeness of it, the safety of it, that matters a lot.
Well, it's
so
I admire
what
hard.
You're doing by taking chances with all
I guess I am, but, you know, it's not like that's why, you know, I try to explain to people and talk to them about a lot of things that you are talking about, but because the thing is, I have the same problems everybody else does. But see, I think one of the problems is they don't think they have problems, and that's the problem, is they don't realize that how hard this is. When they sit down, there's a lot involved in writing this. And sometimes you do sit there and go, can I say this? Should I say that? And Bethany Cross, She helped me get through some of the tough times. She does my shows a lot of times with me, and it was there. She just said, "Just do it," you know. And I go, "Okay, uh-huh. fine." And then I would say, she got sick for a few weeks, and then I go, "Like, I don't think I could do this. I don't know.
Yeah.
This one has
yeah.
come." And then she got better, and then she said, "Just do it." And I go, "Okay." And I have to do that to myself now. I go, "Just write it," you know. And
yeah.
you have
yeah.
to do
just
that.
Just write it.
Just
that's
write
the
it.
Main thing is just to write it. You know, another aspect of this whole thing that I'm confronting is, well, we live in an age of instantaneous everything, you know, instant mashed potatoes and instant
yeah.
messages and instant feedback and instant reviews. And one of the things that I'm seeing is that reviews on places like Amazon.com and various other places are really nothing more than retellings of the story. Okay. Now, that raises a problem because it turns out then not to be a review of the book at all, but in fact to be simply a vote in the popularity contest. How many of these things can you get? In other words, the readers are not prepared to invest the time in the book that the writer spent putting into it. So it
yes.
seems to me that one of the gifts that a reader can give the writer is the gift of time. Take the time to read the book at some depth, see what's actually going on in the book, get beneath what I call the metaphors. Because all stories fundamentally are a metaphoric structure based on a myth, based on a ritual. And most of us just want to read in that metaphoric, you know, lovely language float along in there. So the difference between reading like a reader and reading like a writer is daring to go down into and see what is actually occurring down there in the deep, dark place where those characters are in flux and then mix and trying to find their own quest. In other words, what are the archetypal patterns that exist in all these novels? If a reader does that, then a review starts to make some kind of sense, you see. It starts to say, oh, this guy is tapping into what makes writing important. It's the continuity of the archetypal patterns in our psyche and not the beautiful little words that float on top that we call the story.
See, I know
that's a wrap.
No, it's not. You know, I'm going to tell you something. What's interesting is, you know, I really needed what you're saying today because this is what happens to me, and I know it's happening to me. Just marketing the books. I don't care. You know, and it's like because all day long, when I'm looking on Facebook, when I'm
mm-hmm.
looking on all of these sites, everybody's saying, like me, like this, give me a review. And I just, it's like in my head, I have all these emails that this one tagged me, that one tagged me. I'm going like, I don't know that I can keep doing this mentally because it screws up my head. I know what you said just now is true. But I need someone to keep saying that to me because since the internet became like it is, my
mm-hmm.
writing is I can write fast, but I don't anymore because I'm so busy. If I take an hour to do all of this or 2 hours, and I have to, I want to read the emails, but the emails really unbelievable. Unfortunately, they have no value.
That's correct. You know, one of the things that I've published 12 books or something like that. And in the beginning, I would read reviews because, you know, oh, I want to, you know, gosh, I really, you know, that's really sort of ego balm, you know, salve for your ego. Oh, okay, this guy finally gets it. But then I realized that, you know, what does the review do? It's always after the fact. It's really not for me as a writer, but for someone else to get an idea about what the book is doing.
Yeah.
Well,
at that point,
I quit reading reviews, you see, because it didn't matter to me anymore. The review coming after the fact is not going to change the way I wrote the book. It's not going to change the fact of the book and the language in it and the characters or anything. So what is the purpose of the review? See, unless it's a critical review where the writer of the review takes the time to see the universals in the story and not the peculiar idiosyncrasies of the story in time.
I think what you're saying is very true because I think that once the book is done, just because someone gives you a bad review, you are not writing that book again. But you might next time maybe think of something. I don't know if that's good or bad sometimes because sometimes when you get somebody's, well, like with screenplays, this is a greater example, I think, because with screenplays, people get rejected so fast. It's like unbelievable. You know, you send them to producers, reject, they don't even look at it. Okay, sometimes.
Right.
But, you know, I'm so used to the fact of doing this all these years, getting rejection, saying it's a good read, whatever, and I'm not getting taken for a movie. But I'm so used to it that when I look at the reviews, I go, oh, well, you know, what am I going to say? That everybody makes a huge deal about getting 50 to 100 reviews. I don't think it makes one bit of difference, and I don't think it's helping me in my writing. I think sometimes it hurts because I'm then thinking, well, how about them? They have 100 reviews. I only have 5, you know, and I don't care. 5 is fine. If I had I have 5 good reviews, to me, that's enough. I don't need 100. And I think what's happening is people are giving reviews and they're not reading the book.
Well, I think one of the problems is, you know, we've taken a big hit in the nature of readership, I think, in that, you know, well, fundamentally we quit teaching English, you know, in schools or how to read and how to write. My co-writer, Bob Ray, wrote a book on how to read. You know, how do you read a book? You know, how do you sit down with your pen in hand and read it? Well, he talks about circling the words in the story, you know, the words that recur, the words that come back. And in so doing, what he's pointing out is that good writers tend to work in patterns and transformations, and because language works that way, well, most of us are not trained to look at language as anything other than a surface vehicle for getting, you know, a good feeling. In other words, writers have to write at the edge. They have to take risks in order to awaken in the reader something new, but the reader doesn't have the tools often to look at a piece of writing and look underneath it. I'm sort of rambling on this, Marcia, I think it's kind of an important point for us as writers to see what our readers are doing with what we write. We spend all this time putting it on the page, taking some risks, like Virginia, you know, going out there on the edge, and if people say, oh, she's just doing this, you know, it doesn't really get to the point, which, and go back to that story. That story is about a woman in relationship struggling to find freedom and trying to break loose and to find the empowerment to use her body in a way that is her own, not to be told what to do. Now, how contemporary is that? The Virginia legislature or somebody just said you cannot use the word vagina in the legislative body. Well, first thing you know, these people are banning all of our words. Right. So we can't say the four-letter words that Chaucer made famous. We can't take those kinds of risks. See, so I guess, again, this is part of my ramble and my rant about the what is happening to the innate censorship in American culture right now. On the one hand, we've got a huge force that's saying, you can't say that. And on the other, we've got women like Marcia Casper Cook who want to create characters like Virginia who says, I want to say that, and I'm going to say it right now. So we've got this gigantic war that's going on between the puritanical stripping away of the words that give us the power and the people, the desire of the writers to use them to give their characters power. End of rant. Okay.
No, I think that because, you know, it is true because I think that empowerment for women now, it's a huge issue, you know, but the thing is because sometimes in my own head I go like, okay, be like Virginia. So if I want to, you know, Virginia can do it. I should say, well, Virginia, this is not Virginia Grenier who is, we share World of Ink Network. This is Virginia Templeton we're talking about, my character. So, because Virginia actually, she's in the chat room. Hi, Virginia. She's in the chat room. It's not her. But the thing is that for me, it was very, you know, it's the kind of thing where I go like, okay, what would she do? Because I am not that aggressive to do some of the things she does and how she speaks, but I do think a lot of women sometimes want to be and they can't be because they feel like, oh, my God, can they really say that?
Yeah.
They can.
Yeah.
Now I think they can. And I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a new show with Sigourney Weaver on, the political analyst, I think it's called.
Animal.
Is that it? Yeah, it's so good. I mean, oh, my God. She says what she thinks. And I'm thinking, oh, that's just like Virginia, you know, my character. Because I think that there's not that many characters like that that actually do that. Men can do it
mm-hmm.
all the time, but not women.
Mm-hmm.
And so
let me raise another thing here. In this day and age, how do we as writers find the risky point anyway? I mean, the Marquis de Sade and the 120 Days of Sodom that I reference in my novel, Blood. You know, I mean, there is nothing that human beings can do to one another sexually that is not written down already in 1780. Right? The second thing is there's a book by Georges Bataille called The Story of the Eye, which is just, it takes sexuality and sex and bodies to the extreme. You know, what can you possibly take a risk? How can you possibly risk anything as a writer in this day and age when those people have already written everything that there is to say? You know, so what? How do we find the risky place to go instead of writing safe and doing the same things over and over?
Yep.
That's the real challenge for us as writers. So when you take a risk with Virginia, you know, here's a strong, beautiful, powerful woman who wants what she wants and wants it now and is not going to take any crap, you know, that's a very different kind of risk-taking for a contemporary writer, because she's going for the power of self. She's going for the power of being a woman and what that means to her. So that's a very risky thing for you to do, I think, you know.
See, because now there's a question in the chat room. When does a writer take too much of a risk?
Well, I don't think you can take too much of a risk.
Okay.
Let me give you an example of response to that. I wrote Blood, and one of my reviewers, no, I was priming for an interview, and he was asking, you know, giving me some possible questions. He said, why, when most writers bury sex, do you put it in the seventh scene, which is right up front in the reader's face? And my answer, of course, is this is not a book about sex. This is a book about colonialism and power and evisceration of disempowered people, and let's just get the sex out of the way. All right, get it out of the way. So once you do that, then you're free to go deeper into the story to find things that need to be said. So when you are taking a risk, what you're really doing is saying, I am limited. I can't do that. It is saying, the culture is saying, my mother is saying, my father is saying, don't say that, don't go there. And in fact, you are dammed up as a writer, and you cannot go to the place that you need to go to. That's why I said, you don't have to write shit, fuck, crap, you know, but you have to be able to. Because if you get a character like the Ian McShane character in Deadwood, who cannot speak without those words, You cannot create him if you are dammed up and cannot speak. In memoir writing, we call this, you know, the inciting incident. Most memoirs get stuck in that writing place. They don't want to write on either side of the inciting event. And so what happens is they never finish the memoir. Same thing with a writer taking risks. There is no such thing as too many risks. What you are doing is responding to what you think your readers will feel, because you want to be loved and you want to write safe, and I see it all as a part of a system. So
okay, Virginia,
that's my
Virginia missed the question because her baby was crying. Wait a minute. So okay, Virginia.
She missed the one about
Jack
answering.
Right.
About,
say
you know
it again.
What? Right.
What Jack had said about that, Virginia, the risks, it's never, you can take as many risks as you want. That's, if
yes.
the character
that,
you get,
that,
you just take the risk.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I couldn't
yeah,
quite hear that. So.
She didn't hear what you said
about
taking risks. I was just repeating that you, in your opinion.
Can't take too many risks was his answer.
Right.
Right, Jack?
You can't take too many risks. No,
right,
I don't think you can.
Mm-hmm.
If you limit yourself, you know, then, you know, D.H. Lawrence would never have written later Chatterley's Lover. Henry Miller would never have written The Tropic of Cancer and The Tropic of Capricorn. In other words, the risk is what opens up the things. The risk is what allows us to open the doors onto worlds that we don't yet know exist. And it's only by opening the door, taking the risk, that we can discover new things to say. Writing is not, in my view, just a recapitulation of civilization. Writing is a way of finding who and what we are and using language to make discoveries about what we can be. See? And
yeah,
we always write the same
thing. If you write the same thing,
sense,
right.
Marcia?
No, it does very much, because, you know, I really don't write. My characters are never the same. I don't really, I don't know if they are. I don't think anybody would think that, because I don't. I take each character individually, and, you know, as to what they do and who they are, and as they grow in the story. And in this particular character, I mean, I know a lot of different things about her. I'm not sure that I'll use them all, but I know her. Okay, I know a lot of things that has happened to her, because in our own lives, what's happened to us makes us who we are. We don't always say everything that happened to us, but we're...
There's another question.
Oh, okay.
There's another question.
Okay.
Do you think because a lot of writers do limit themselves or are afraid to open themselves, this is why they don't see publication?
Why they don't get publication?
Yeah.
Why they don't get because they won't open themselves and they limit themselves.
Yeah. Well, self-limitation, well, let me put it this way. When I first started doing timed writing or writing practice that I picked up from Bob Ray, who got it from Natalie Goldberg, who got it from the Beatniks, this kind of thing, the thing she said was, write about your childhood for a year, you know. In other words, there is no place you can go until you have solved all the problems of the closed doors and the boxes that you've got yourself into. And she says, when you get to that point of saying, oh, I can't write that, she says, go ahead and write it, because chances are it's your third grade teacher saying, Marcia, you didn't cross your T's, or your mom saying, Marcia, be sure to put on clean underwear.
Right.
In other words, these are limitations from the past that are impinging upon our creativity as writers in the present. And that is the real severe problem. In other words, most writers don't take risks because they want to be loved. And they know that if they say those words or put those characters in those positions, that somebody will say, oh, my God, you look at that. See?
Right.
So when you back away, the backing away for a writer is just about the worst thing in the world that can happen. When I write, and when I tell writers about how to write sex scenes, I say, take it all the way to the edge. Let's see the fluids. Let's see the ejaculation. Let's see the hot, sweaty kind of stuff. And then back away to your comfort level. In other words,
You got to, okay, and, you know, I know, like, Virginia is talking, and I'm just going to say something. I know that Virginia and I do a show together, like, What a Success show. I definitely know that Virginia will have you on the show again, the two of us, because we do a show together, and I know she would like to, because I'm so glad she listened to you today, because I keep saying, listen to Jack, you know, because she's got three kids, so it's hard sometimes. But she was, you know, because she used to work at Fredericks of Hollywood. Okay, and she's going to use that in her head, but you know,
perfect.
She does that. You know,
yeah. Well,
but,
Helen,
you know,
I was in Fredericks one day with a woman, and this elderly couple were in there, and the woman said to the man, "Where was all this stuff 30 years ago?" In other words, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just had to do that.
That's true, though. You know, but the truth is, though, is, you know, I mean, you know, even, you know, I'm on this Pinterest, which is on, it's like Facebook and Twitter. I don't know if you know about that yet. It's great. It's called Pinterest.
Mm-hmm.
And
I don't.
Yeah, I'll get you the link. And people are putting on so many, they're putting on movies and clothes and jewelry and books and everything. It's a great, you know what, maybe, JD, if maybe you'll put that in the chat room, Pinterest.
Yeah, I'm doing that right now.
All right, and so there's like all these, like I have, you make little boards for your characters, for people, whatever. I did it for a character, for Virginia. And I wrote Virginia Templeton's clothes, like what she would wear. And every time then you pin something there, and her stuff is very, very sexy, revealing, you know. And, you know, it's a lot different than I dress. And then sometimes, like now, I'm thinking, well, maybe I should. Because, you know, I've always been the same type of person. I look a certain way. You know, I mean, I change a lot. You know, my hair I changed. I changed a lot of stuff. But I never really went into anything unusual. And I'm thinking, like, sometimes you can learn from your characters that you can, you know, move, be a little freer. Because women, when they grow up, they're not always as free as men.
Right.
And we don't even know we're not until we realize.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have bumped into with some of the erotica writers is the women who have children, you know, and they still want to write erotica, but they're, in a way, they are limited by the fact that they have children and they don't necessarily want the children to read or see the stuff that they have done.
Well, that's why they use different names. I had one show where I had five writers on. They all had different names. I was going crazy because I knew their other names. I was going like, okay, I was trying to not call them because they didn't really want anybody to know. Do you so you think even if they have children, that how do you feel about that? That is a big problem for writers that do erotica.
Well, yeah, it seems to me that what we have to do is realize that children are human beings too, and they are driven by the same biological genetic urges that adults have. And when they become adults, you know, one of the problems that we often have is that children are dammed up by those kinds of limitations we place on them. I'm not saying expose kids to stuff, but what I am saying is the children are going to grow up and they are going to want to be full human beings, and part of the full human being experience is being exposed to the kind of sexuality that drives us as, you know, as adults. So what I say is don't be afraid of anything. Don't be afraid of your children or your mother or your grandmother or your aunt or the censor, because, you know, we're in a unique place in time right now where we do have the ability to write things without going to jail. And we do have the ability.
My grandmother in the old days, my grandmother lived to like 101. I mean, it was like, and she read romance books. And she read all those, they had used to have those romance magazines. They don't do those anymore. I mean, they had all these things. And, you know, and she always, she believed in romance. So I think she read Harold Robbins, you know, years ago.
Yeah.
And it, when you look at those books, those are the same kind of stories people are writing. And they made movies out of, and it was a whole different, you know, now it, they make more of a deal, but actually kids are watching a lot on TV.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of that. You know, there's sex as titillation, you know, where you don't ever say anything. You use euphemisms. Yeah. There is sex as, you know, overt, you know, straightforward kinds of things where you say things that you mean. And then there's sex as implication. And one of the things that this woman, Sarah Martinez, in her book Sex and Death in the American Novel is doing is talking about the implications of sex as a possible way to explore other things. In other words, she says that sex at this level is a metaphor for writing. And what is it? It's a way to expose oneself. It's a way to get to the core of what and who we are. It is a full acknowledgement of the biology of being. And so she uses sex not necessarily to titillate. She doesn't mask it. But she uses it to go beyond. Well,
do you think she'd
want to
come on the show? Do you think she'd want to come? She sounds very interesting.
Oh, I think she'd love to. I'll get her in touch with you.
Okay, because you know, honestly, it is difficult for people, and that's why, you know, I'm so happy I did it. I had a great time doing it, and I'm going to do a second and third of the series. But I think that it does free you, because once you've already done that.
Mm-hmm.
You just did it, you know, and I'm...
Where do you go?
Right.
See, there you bumped into what
right.
I was talking about earlier about the writer writing. Say, well, you've done that, you know how to do it, so you do it again.
Right.
And in so doing, it becomes an endless repetition of the same thing. So how do you go to the next?
It was interesting
what
because,
risk is there
you know,
to take after you've already put her in lace panties, you know, and a
see-through,
you know,
like,
bra? What are you going
to
do?
Right, and like my editor, I was afraid to give it to him in some ways, you know, and to give it to him, I'm thinking what he thought, but then when he was done, he was like, okay, fine, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, fine, and he said, maybe I should write one. I'm like, okay, write one, you know, and it's like, I think it's just very freeing, and but I did, you know, I think sometimes you do need a little push, and that's, you know, what happens, you know, sometimes you need a little push, and it works.
Well, look at it this way, Marcia. It seems to me that once you have written a story like Virginia, that it becomes easier then to develop a more textured, deeper character. character in some other genre or some other form,
yeah,
because you know what's underneath that now.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
you can actually go deeper into the character. And that's what I mean by taking the risk to open new doorways.
Yeah.
If you had you not written Virginia, you would not be able to write the next thing that builds on Virginia and what the kind of freedom that she has experienced. So it seems to me that you are example, a living, walking, breathing example of what it means for a writer to take risks as a form to liberate you so that you can actually go deeper into other genres or other types of writing. I think
yeah,
it's admirable that you do that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
not,
you.
Not,
I don't know. You know, I just kind of do it, and I don't always think about it, and I just do it. And that's what I miss. And that's why, you know, I know there's a lot of writers out there that are really wanting to write more than doing all this marketing. And what you're saying about the reviews, and these are the things that people need to hear, because I think they get caught up in a, and we are writers, and that's what we need to write. I like sometimes I'm beginning to think now there's a lot of people that are writing, but they're not really writers. A writer
mm-hmm.
is like that's all they think about. I mean, that is. I look at someone, and sometimes I'll go, oh, look at that character, and it's not, it's a person. So I got to remember they're a person,
right.
You know. And when we write, you know, and as writers, I do believe that, you know, like a lot of times in real life, I say, just try to do this. And they'll go, no, you can't. But because I'm a writer and I've done so many different characters, I actually do believe if you really try a lot of things, it can get done. You can get the job done. By saying no, you may never get that job done. But if you say, I can
right,
do this
right.
and take it as a challenge.
Well, one of the things I think you bring up in that in that discussion there is in the world of Amazon reviews, what happens is many, many good writers turn into what I call published authors. Now, a published author is a person who's written a book or two dozen books or whatever it is, but is spending more time doing the promotion of the book than sitting down and writing. So you have to make a decision as a writer. What is important? Is it being loved by the showing up the number of reviews, you know, that kind of thing, or is it writing this, opening new doorways, stepping into a new world, and creating a new place. See, so what happens is once we become successful, we become victims of our own success because that published author syndrome eats our soul and cuts us away from the writing. So you really have to make a decision in there, and in the Amazon world, it's really crucial.
Yeah.
Because the publishers are not going to spend any money on you. They're not going to promote you in books and or, you know, in magazines and ads and stuff. You have to do it yourself. If you don't do it yourself, it doesn't get done. And
yeah.
So what happens is you have to spend so much time promoting your own work that you forget you're a writer. You know, and that
how do you end
real,
that? I mean, there's no ending of that because, you know, if you
see an end to it.
Yeah,
I don't see an end to it.
Yeah.
Well, that gets us to the question of what's the industry becoming, you
yeah.
see. Back in the old days, there's a story about Kurt Vonnegut. I think he tells it in something, Grand Falloons, in one of his essays. He said he was kind of a mid-list writer with a lot of books on the shelf and they weren't really selling. And then one day the publisher discovered that certain of his books were really moving, and so they started pushing the rest of them. Well, what this gets us to is the problem that writers, of mid-list writers, have. Publishing houses no longer carry an inventory, so they have no way, no backlog, no whatever it is. Everything is POD, instant on demand, on Amazon, so you have no way of knowing, except by those numbers, you know, what is actually selling. So you're kind of scrapped. You have to depend on Amazon to give you who's reading your book, if anybody's reading your book.
You know, I'll tell you, actually, you know, I just wanted to stop you for 1 minute. Now, Fran Lewis is in the chat room, and Fran Lewis also does shows with us, and she does shows with the Red River. And Fran Lewis gives a book review like you've never – I mean, it's so thoroughly detailed, and almost every author that she does says to her, you know, you actually got what I'm saying. And she absolutely gets it. I'm going to send you some of her reviews are unbelievable because she just, and people can use them as synopsis. She's a reading expert and she did it for 36 years. But when she's done with your review, some of the points that you thought nobody might get, she gets. And that's a review. And that is such, because she's actually talking to the characters and talking to the person that wrote the book, not just saying, oh, I love this book. You know, it was really good. Okay, bye. You know, and.
Well, see, what she's doing there, Marcia, is she is giving the writer back something. She's giving the writer the gift of time. She's taking the time to explore the book and see what's actually there. See how, in other words, that she, in fact, at that level becomes the perfect reviewer because she doesn't just see the words. She sees what's under the words. She sees what has been driving the characters. I think that's so important for us to learn as readers not to skim. One of the death knells, I think, of what we're trying to be as writers is this free book syndrome thing. You know, when Blood went free for 3 days, it jumped up to like, you know, 3,000 on the Amazon thing, and yet, as far as I know, no one read it. They downloaded it.
So that's an interesting thing. Okay, you know, we talk about this all the time, and I, you know, I don't know what to do anymore. I mean, I honestly, so I just said to, I talked to myself last night after, you know, doing some of this marketing. I went like, I have to stop this because I don't even know anymore. You know, if, should I give a book free? Shouldn't I give a book free? I mean, and it's like some people say yes, some people say no. And I've had people on the show that have like really thousands and thousands and thousands of people that have, you know, they're in contact with, but I don't, some of them have actually started to sell a lot of books, but it's just, I don't know anymore. You know, it's so different.
What would you rather see
a writer do? What would, do you think they should? I mean, there's a question in the chat room.
I think that one, well, Bob Ray, my good friend and writing partner.
See, he's going to come on too,
says,
right? He's going to come on, right?
He is going to come. I hope so. I hope you know, we'll connect him. He says, most of the people are worried about getting the reviews. I'm worried about writing the next sentence. He says, I'm really into the sentences now.
That's
well, what a wonderful place to be as a writer.
Okay.
You know, I'm worried about the sentence. I'm not worried.
Okay.
You know, and here's the upside. Here's the upside of the Amazon instant message world. We no longer, in effect, need publishers. I have a joke. I have a joke that I tell people when I give a talk or something. I say, you know, I get the same number of readers for my books, whether they're published or not. All right, now think about that. All right. Well, what the Amazon world has done is free us, you know, from the tyranny of the publisher. If they don't like it, publish it yourself. If it's no good, your readers won't read it, you know. And so there's an upside to this that lets us as writers say, okay, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about the sentence. And Bob, because he's worried about the sentence, is able to write the next sentence and the next sentence and the next chapter and the next sentence.
That's exactly right. You're right. That's exactly true.
Yeah.
It is.
See, so we don't have to be held captive to the whim, and I'm going to make an insult here, to a Wellesley graduate hired as a reader for some, you know, some agent. You know, we can go directly to the source. We can publish these books ourselves. And if they don't sell, then it's nobody's fault but our own. That's the upside. You know, we do have control over the means of production and the means of distribution. So, you know, there's an upside to it. And I see that as a very positive side.
Yeah, because Fran, she's in the chat room talking about this. And, you know, she has
a question here, too.
Yeah, go ahead. Read it.
There's a question. Let me see. Listen. Jack, what do you think about giving away books for free? Is it do any good?
That's a good question. I talked to Joanne Buchanan about that.
Yeah.
She, you know, has written several books, Wolf, and stuff like that. She's of a mind that it really doesn't have an impact on sales. And so the only thing you can, giving away the book free, you know, on Amazon, is a lot like publishing the book yourself, buying 50 copies and distributing it to your friends. It's the same thing, right? We all give books away.
Yeah.
So I don't see much difference between those two. If you're doing it with the hope and expectation of increased sales, I'm not sure that'll happen.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely not sure that'll happen. And I think that Joanne would agree with me.
Yes,
Gary
definitely.
Alexander, who is a mystery novelist living in Seattle, has published a series of books with a character named Buster there, you know, and he puts his books up for free. I have not talked to him about the monetary spinoff of that, whether he does accrue some good but I doubt it. I really do. And the reason, I think, is that people take the free book, put it on their Kindle, but never bother to read it, which is, you see, they're not honoring the writer by giving them back the time, you see. I mean, I can spend a year writing a book.
Because they get a free book. I didn't want to interrupt you, but it's just like I'm thinking about one thing. Sometimes they give people give free books away lately, and then somebody gets the book, let's just say. Then they write a review.
Yeah.
They didn't even like the book. They didn't want the book, and they write a bad review, which is ridiculous because they didn't want the book, like the book, but they entered a contest and they got the book.
Well, that's the risk you take in the Amazon world, I'm
right.
afraid.
Well, right.
You know,
so then, right.
We have no control
right.
over who hates
yes.
us either.
Right. That's the other thing. Right. See, that's
yeah.
the whole thing, and I'm seeing who's in the chat room because I know who's in all these people in the chat room, and. We're always talking about this subject. Oh, my God. Because it's never ending. And Joanne, I've talked to her on the phone so many times about this. And what you're saying is true. One way or another, it's either good or bad, but it's going to be turn out the same.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
one way.
It doesn't matter. And if you don't read it, you know, well, here, let me go back and say one thing, Mark. As a teacher, I often found that there were two stories. There was a story that the writer wanted to write, and there's a story that wants to be told. And then there's this third thing. There's a story that the reader wanted you to write and expects you to have written, and if that doesn't meet the expectation, the reader says, oh, phooey, this is a bad book, instead
yeah.
of saying, what has the writer done here that is not part of my expectation? Mozart used to say when he was composing, he said, you don't have to give them what they expect, but what you give them should be better than what they expected.
Right, that's true.
Well, that gets...
You know, it's true. These are really true. These are so true. I mean, we talk about this all the time because I do this in the chat room, and we do talk about these things. And, you know, it's interesting that you said that. I did a memoir on a Holocaust survivor. One of the reviews, the woman did not like the part. There was a part where she got remarried and the survivor, and she didn't invite her daughter to the wedding,
right.
her little daughter. So the reader... The reviewer wrote that she thought that was terrible, okay? And she started to talk about that, and I'm thinking, like, and I actually responded to that because I've said this on the show before. This is her life. I was writing her life. I can't change it. The daughter
exactly.
wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's like she wanted the daughter to come to the wedding, but that's not what the character, that's not what the writer,
right.
the person
yeah.
that lived
yeah.
the life, and it was a true story.
Yeah.
How can you change
yeah.
a true story? You can't.
Well, see, that's why the reader always has this thing in his or her mind. And that's why, you know, well, I work with people sitting around the table. We'll write a scene and type it up and go back and read it to one another and work on it. And you'd be surprised at how many times when you're reading things out loud, your reader friends will actually read the wrong word because it's not what they expect.
Right.
And when you do not meet the expectation, they stumble. So what that tells me is there's a story in their head that they're expecting you as the writer to fulfill. They are not saying, okay, what can you give me as a writer that I don't have? You know, it's all a one-way street. See, we're expected to, and I'm, you know, Baudelaire in his poem called La Fontaine de Saint calls it, hypocrite lecteur, ressemblable mon frère. He says, you hypocrite reader, my lookalike, my brother. In other words, the tyranny of the reader is what makes it so difficult for us to be writers because the reader does not want to accept the world we're building but expects us to accommodate the world that is in the reader's head.
See,
now, that
you're right, because
is
I know Fran
horrible.
Lewis, she keeps listening, and she said these things so many times because it's really true what you're saying. I mean, it's so true. It's unbelievable. You know, in the chat room, also, if you're going to send your book, where are the good places to post reviews, though, I mean, that you would look at? If you were going to go buy a book, would you look at the reviews, or would you go to certain spots and, you know, like any of the sites that are out there?
Let's ask another question and kind of answer that.
Okay.
Have you ever been influenced to buy a book by a review, good or bad?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
And
Movie either. I don't either. I don't care.
Yeah, that's a real dilemma. Yeah. I wrote a review of a poetry book called No Father Can Save Her, and I placed it on a a blog called Gently Read Literature, and I have no idea if anyone read that review at all, other than the writer of the book and the editor who posted it, you see.
Yeah.
So I find myself flailing, you know, in the wind here against reviews. What good do they do except to list a set of numbers? So when you ask, where do you send for a review, where do you... Is that the question? Where do you send the book to get a good review?
Right. You're answering it. You answered it right. But, I mean, you answered it good. But the thing is that because I think a lot of book reviewers, and Fran and, well, Virginia's a book reviewer. There's a lot of, and JD is a book reviewer. You got a lot of book reviewers. Bethany Cross, they all have done that. So they're wondering, you know, where to place the book reviews for the reader, if there are any other...
Well, one of the things I think you have to do these days is find the websites and the blogs that do book reviews. That's why this Gently Read Literature was an insight to me, because he publishes very high class stuff. I mean, it's a wonderful website. I mean, I have never seen this quality on
a
blog.
What's it called, though? What's it called?
It's called Gently Read Literature,
okay,
and that's the title of the blog. But he writes, he publishes reviews, he publishes interviews, he publishes, you know, all kinds of things. But it's a quality publication. So it seems to me that as writers, what we can do is locate those blogs where the editors or the writers of those blogs have a pretty strong sense of what writing is in the world, instead of just sending it off to somebody who reviews, you know, books willy-nilly or something. So
yes.
I think this is a part of being the PA, Marcia, the published author. You have to do the work yourself. I mean, no one's going to do it for you. And so you just have to, you know, work it that way. I have hooked up with a writer, a novelist, a blogger. Her name is Deborah Maxwell Allen. And she has a blog called Writing While the Rice Boils. It's about tips for writers, but she also does interviews, and so you have to solicit something, you know, in order to get it done. So what writers can do, instead of sending a book cold to a reviewer, is hook up with those blogs where the interviewers are and ask them point blank, would you post an interview with me? And I did that with Deborah, and she sent me a list of questions. I answered the questions in writing, and she posted it in two parts. So the writer, the downside of that is the time that I spent answering those questions is time I did not spend on my novel. Bam, end of story. See.
Okay. So, Jack, there's one more question in the chat room here. Let me see. It's about, let me find it again. It scrolled up a little. Here. Do you think authors need to promote their reviews more so fans and readers really take the time to read them?
Could you repeat that?
Okay, yeah. Let me see here. Do you think authors need to promote their reviews more so fans and readers really take the time to read them? I guess the question is...
I'm back in. You know,
that's a tough question, Jack.
I was just trying to keep us talking.
I know, because they went, you know, they kicked me. I don't know what happens sometimes. That just happens.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was just asking Jack a question.
It seems to me that
posting, you know, spreading the reviews around, good or bad, I'm so conflicted by all this, because every time that you spend an hour promoting your review, you're working into the published author thing. You see, this is the downside of the new universe of publishing. You have to do everything yourself, and so you have to spend time doing that, and the effect that you get from reposting reviews is probably negative.
Yeah.
I just don't know how to, Marcia, maybe you can answer.
I think this is the big problem everybody has. But, you know, I really do want to ask you a couple of questions that are, you know, I wanted to ask you about something that is a very tough question for people. It's a tough thing for people to write. It's that log line. You know, this is, it's very hard to write what your book or script is like in one sentence. How do you manage to do that? That's
yeah,
the
log
I find
line,
it horrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
well, what I do, the log line for Black Madonna in Blue is, you know, a mechanic and a gambler, you know, struggle in a life and death fight for a mysterious black woman. All right, well, that's a log line, right?
Right, right.
And it turns out that the log line is like the title of the book. It is the most highly compressed version of the book.
Okay.
Now,
that doesn't say
how you do it, but
right.
We know what it has to be, see? And so what the log line is very much like a real tight, compressed form. Okay, I've got three characters. They're locked in some kind of a struggle. I've got two men and a woman, so I know I have a love triangle. I can anticipate some of that, but what kind of a story have you given me? And that's the curiosity. I worked with an agent, Bob Ray. His name was Ben Kamsler way, way back in the old days. And he said, I reject most manuscripts because it fails to engage in the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay, now, everybody said that since time immemorial. If the first sentence doesn't work, the thing is not... Think of the log line as the first sentence that makes the reader, viewer, listen, want to know more. And that's all I can say about it. There is no formula, as far as I know.
All right.
There
that's an interesting, that's an interesting way to do
yeah.
it, though. It's an interesting way to think about it, because I do think that is a number one problem. And, you know, this is, you know, there's so many problems that people, you know, don't realize how much, even just a sentence, and how much all of this takes time. I mean, this is really time. You know, like you're saying, the title is so important, and it's just all of these factors that take into the day, that there's only so many hours in the day. But mostly important is writing, but I see what you're saying about the title, though, and how it has to engage in what, because otherwise they won't read the book or look at the script, because they don't know, they want to know fast what it's about, kind of.
Yeah, I think, well, again, what we're confronting is the problem of what readers expect and what writers want to do. In other words, let me trip out here for a moment, Marcia.
Okay.
I'm preparing to do a workshop for the Pacific Northwest Writers. It's in Seattle in November, all right? And the title of the workshop is Three Domains in Sex Writing. Okay, now think about that. So what I've done is I've broken it into three parts. Pornography, you know, where you talk about body parts and orgasm. It's self-contained.
Right.
There's no reference beyond the media. Then the second part is eroticism, which is celebration of the sensual body pleasure ritualized for effect. And then there's a third category, which is literary sex writing. What you're trying to do there is to explore the meaning of sex. Is it timeless? Is it universal? Explore the meaning of gender. What is gender in our writing, you see?
Yeah.
So this is one of the things that I think writers have to confront is, what are you doing? Who are you doing it for? What level of sexuality are you going to put into the writing? Does the reader expect from the title, you know, if you say, Bambi and the three blacksmiths, well, I'm pretty sure that's not going to be a literary novel, right? And it's certainly not going to be erotic. On the other hand, Everybody Wants Her, which is the title of the Virginia book, or the Virginia story, you know, as opposed to, you know, something like, you know, Three Goats and a Pig, you know, you know, I mean, we're talking pornography, see? So the title tells you everything. That what the reader needs to know is, what are the implications of what you have given me? You know,
you have so many good ideas, and just the way you say it, I mean, you just, because you've gone over this over many, many, many times on all your, you know, workshops, whatever you do, and it's so helpful, because, you know, there's so many writers out there that go through the same problems, and they give up because they go, oh, forget it, but it really is hard, but you have it down in the science, but I'm sure when you're writing, you feel the same pressures that we all do.
Nothing
right.
is, you know, well, right. Here's a story, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or not. The Thomas Mann, you know, who wrote Death in Venice and Dr. Faustus and all that, it is said that when he finished the book, you know, and wrote The End, he rolled that last page out, rolled a new page in, and typed the title of the next book. In other words, it's an ongoing, never-ending process.
Yeah, right.
But it always starts, as every writer knows, with a blank page and a pencil or a typewriter.
Yeah.
And so we're all faced with the same thing. But that's where what Bob Ray and Natalie Goldberg and these other writers have helped me do is sit down and realize, well, don't just start writing about the writing.
Yeah.
So we have a storyline that says, I want to write a story about a man, a woman, a horse, a dog, a boy, who, right? Well, then I add three words. I want to write a story about a woman who wants. I want to write a story about a woman who needs. I want to write a story about a woman who can't have. In other words, grow the character through these three words, want, need, and can't. Why?
Okay.
Because want means this is physical world. They want that Cadillac, you know. What they really need is their father's love, but they can't have anything. They can't have that. Well, can't, a negative, cannot have that, leads the character to action. Because if the character takes action to get what she wants, you know, then you've got a story. And then you talk about what is the thing that she wants. Well, let's call that the sacred object, or let's call that the, you know, whatever you want, the object, the Holy Grail. So in order to get the Holy Grail of her father's love, she must do this, so she takes action. So I never have to start cold with the blank page. I start writing, I want to write a story about two boys looking for. See,
I do that to myself a lot, like the can't. When you say can't, then I go, like, yes, I can do this, and I do this. And Bethany, of course, she's in the chat room, and the truth is I would say that I can't do this. I go, like, I'm going to do this. And that's what I say in my head all the time. I go, I am going to do this. And I'm going to, like, even last night I was doing this website. I said, I don't care if I have to stay up till 4 in the morning. I'm getting a website because that's how I am. And in my regular life, it does rub off because I don't want to say I can't do it because I can do it. I just have to figure out when I'm going to do it. But I, you know,
right.
And it's like, you're right. These are very, this, because we all have these pressures. It's very good just to just sit there and say, I'm writing about.
Yeah. And it's very, on my blog site, on the blog that Bob and I hold, it's called Bob and Jack's Writing Blog. I have a whole section in there about writing about Gabriella and the Widow, this new novel that's coming in November.
Yes.
And I'm doing a pitch here. You don't mind these bold, you know, bald-faced pitches, do you? You know,
I put them out already. I like to. No, we all want to know what you do because it's so interesting. Because, you know, I mean, you have so many of the same. You're telling us about all these problems that we have and how to break through them, and that's what writers need to hear. You know,
right.
And
well,
we don't
one of the things with Gabriella, what I did was write about what I call the spine. Now, the spine is something that I picked up from the screenwriters and specifically from Sidney Pollack in a lecture that he gave to the screenwriting program. The spine
I loved his work.
The spine, my goodness, this is the most important thing you can ever discover as a novelist, because what it is, it's a set of polarities that drive the characters and drive the action. He said that when he was filming Out of Africa, he did not know what the spine of that film was until he was shooting the third reel, and then he realized that the spine of that is possession, dispossession. Everything in there is about possessing or not being possessed. So the main character, the woman, she wants to possess the land, she wants to possess the men, she wants to possess the servants, so she does these kinds of things. He, on the other hand, doesn't want to be possessed. He wants to be free. He, you know, he doesn't want that. So it's in the realization that this novel Out of Africa and the film was built on a set of polarities, gave him the idea about how to film the rest of it. And so what we discover as novelists and what I discovered in Gabriella is that the spine gives me a way to string together the metaphors. And so I discovered that in Gabriella, the spine is built on a set of polarities of thick and thin. The main character, Gabriella, is a thin character. She's skinny. She jeans almost fall off of her. She doesn't own anything. The widow, on the other hand, is thick with objects and possessions and a house and a pass and men and jewelry.
Yeah.
So she's thick and thin. Well, that gives me then a way to write about the scenes and to put that spine index into every scene that I write. So by writing about the writing, discovering the spine in Gabriella, I made it a better book. But I made it a better book because I understood the techniques of screenwriting about how to build the spine into the metaphors.
It's a lot to take in. It is because it's a lot to take in because there is so much, you know, that does make. This is really what people want. You know, when they see a movie, they want to see a good character. I mean, I like to see Al Pacino when he played Scarface. You know, the movie might be, you know, whatever, but you are not forgetting that movie, and you're not going to forget him playing it. But it's tough to watch. There's some scenes that I close my eyes. Sometimes there's one scene where they're in the bathroom when they're, like, just slicing people, and it's like, oh, my God. But you love that movie, and you're remembering it because it's so you want what you write to be memorable on something. I once read that somebody said, if you remember a movie, certain scenes, that's really all a writer can ask for, is that you remember that, you know, in your mind.
Yep.
You don't have to remember word for word.
Well, one of the ways I phrase that is, you know, the scene is, well, let me back up. Bob and I really feel that the fundamental unit of fiction is not a chapter but a scene.
Right.
And the reason for that is chapters can be any number of 3 scenes, 4 scenes, 1 scene, you know. How long is a chapter? It can be 1 page. It can be 1 sentence.
Right.
So it's an arbitrary thing.
Well, that's exactly how I think, Jack. I think
A scene is more than that. A scene has all these other attributes to it. So what you're saying is, if in movies they call it the million-dollar scene, and I'll give an example in a minute. But what we would say is, you know, you gotta read this book because there's a scene where, all right. Once you get that particular scene that becomes the hallmark of that book, you can direct your readers to it and say, wow, you just got to read this scene because. The example that I picked up in the screenwriting world is this is old days before computer graphics. In the movie Gremlins, there's a line in the script that says, and then the house imploded. Think about that. Well, that's called the million-dollar scene. What they did was they actually built a scale model of the house, and just like Nero collapsing the boat that his mother was in the Colosseum, they had ropes and ties and all this stuff, so that at a certain point they yanked all this, and sure enough, the house imploded. You know, it collapsed.
Yeah.
But this is what we mean. There's that one scene. If you don't think in scenes, then you cannot possibly construct the story in a way that allows you to say, wow, you have got to look at this book because you got to see this scene. And so that's where we talk about scene and chapter and stuff like that. All right.
I'm an artist, and I see pictures. And that's exactly how I write. So I know exactly what you're saying. That's so interesting to me that you're saying that, because it's hard to find people who do that too. I see scenes, and that's really true though.
One of the things that we talk about is stories are told not with dialogue but action and image.
Yep.
In other words, there's a wonderful article by a guy named Paul Sereno. He's a psychologist down at San Diego in California, and he wrote an article called A Brain That Talks. And he says that there is no special organelle for language and speech. It's spread all over and stuff like that. He says what happened is when we evolved, as language evolved, we co-opted the visual cortex. And so when you say to somebody, oh, I see, you really mean it. You are seeing it in your mind's eye, in your brain. We as writers have an obligation to give the reader pictures. So you as an artist who give the reader pictures or give the viewer pictures understand that the writer must also give the reader pictures, or you're bypassing that wonderful brain part called the visual cortex.
Yeah.
And that's where the technology and understanding of neurology and science helps us become better writers, because it takes us into the body. Once we're in the body, then we understand how it works, and we can make our writing better because we make it more visual, we make it more dynamic.
That dynamic.
I've never
that's
heard it
thing.
Spoken before. I don't think I've ever heard it spoken before, Jack. You know, it's so funny.
Well, because you've never
that.
Really talked to Jack, never heard him. That's why he's an incredible person, because the things that he says, after he says them, you go, oh, that's right. That's right.
Well, let me tell you, everything I know, I learned from somebody else. All right. So,
well, we all do
for
that,
example,
but, you know, but it's how you perceive it, though. But, it, you know, we could all learn the same
book.
Thing.
There's a great book by Eric Kendall, Nobel Prize winner. He's a neurophysiologist or a neuroscientist. The book is called The Age of Insight. And in The Age of Insight, he takes apart a photograph of one of Gustav Klimt's paintings called Judith and Holofernes. And what he does, he analyzes the painting, but then he talks about what is happening in the human brain with each aspect of the perception of the painting. In other words, he equates the perception to a physiology, to a neurology, and he says, writers must start to pay more attention to the neurosciences.
Well, yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, but writers have to pay attention, you know, and writers do pay attention to things that I think that other people don't, you know, because, you know, when you look at somebody, you're not looking at them like what they're wearing, but you're listening to them in a different way, and it's just like you're listening to what they say, because then you're trying to figure out some, you know, how they are. You know, like a lot of times when we meet people, I do, you know, and then my friends and my husband, we're, my son, we're all talking about, like, I will start talking to a person. I really enjoy talking to people and listening to their stories, because I just think you get so much out of that, because there's so many different kinds of people. And if you don't open up your eyes and talk to different people, I don't think you can be a good writer, because you have to live in the world we live in.
Right.
Well, you know, one of the things,
experiences.
One of the things that we picked up from the screenwriters also was exactly what you're talking about. They call it behavior, and you can only see behavior, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can only see what they do. What do they do is really more important than what they say.
Yeah.
And so if you are not, well, Stuart Stern and Jeff and Randy Sue Coburn wrote a fascinating screenplay with Alan Rudolph called Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle. You may have seen it.
Yeah.
And they spend hours observing people, going out and just sitting and watching.
Yeah. And I love
what
that.
What is this person doing that, you know, what is this person doing that I can steal and use in my characterization? Right. But the fact is, they spend time observing. They have sections of the screenwriting program where they talk about observation, going out and observing things. So unless we become astute observers of the body, you know, we can never become really good writers, because we don't understand how the body fits in time and space. And so we've got this whole charge upon us as writers not to write from inside our heads, but to write, you know, about behavior. But at the same time, you can't be limited by realism. See,
so
if you're limited by realism...
I think what you're saying today, though, basically is, I didn't want to interrupt you, but basically was what you're saying is just go out there and write and don't hold back.
That's correct. That's correct. Take the risk. Take the risk. Go out there and see how close to the edge you can get and how far over you can fall. And remember this, that writing is a golden thread that you hold in your teeth. When you jump over the edge, it will hold you up. And even if you let go, it won't matter. But in order to sing, you have to open your mouth and let go. You'll never hit bottom. In other words, there is no limitation. There is no words do not kill. Words rejuvenate and regenerate and make life. So I go back to the original thing we were talking about. Take the risk, for God's
sake. Right. Yep.
Be brave.
I'm ready
bold.
To go take that. I am taking the risk. That's my life. My life, I'm always changing things. Every day, my husband and I used to work together. We don't anymore, but it was like, I worked for doctors, and I helped him out for many years, and then he's doing something different. But anyway, it was like every day I had a new idea. He'd go like, oh, my God. It's like every single day I come up with an idea. I do. I really do. You know, and people that know me that are listening, every day I get something else I'm thinking of. And I guess I was that kind of a child. I don't know. But I think I was, now that I look back, because it's like I'm always going, okay, what about this? And maybe we'll do this, and let's try this. And the truth is, if it doesn't work, I'm okay with that, because if I don't try it, I'm not going to know it doesn't work.
And there's always something else to try, you see.
And
it's endless. Language is infinite. Language is infinite. Human experience may not be infinite. You know, I've often thought about this. There are kind of like, maybe, are there a limited number of stories? I don't know. You know, it's a, Bob and I worked on a notion that we call core stories, and we've come up with seven core stories, and they're variations, of course. But you know, like there's queen replacement. You know, a man kills his wife and gets another woman. There's king replacement. You know, the woman kills her husband and gets another man. There's the grail quest. There's the coming of age for male. There's the coming of age for female. And the metaphor, by the way, for coming of age for the female core story is the ugly duckling. And if you think about it, you know, this is a perfect metaphor for what women do. They're awkward, they're gawky, they got acne. Suddenly they get breasts, they grow hair, and by God, they turn into this beautiful being. See, so that becomes the male coming of age story. On the core story is, of course, a grail quest where he's looking for something and he has to become scarred in order to become a man. So it usually involves ritual combat. You know, they're these core stories. So, but the question is, language is infinite. We can construct any number of sentences from now to the end of time and never say the same thing twice. But there may not be an unlimited or infinite number of stories. And that kind of troubles me as a writer.
That
gets me back to the whole question of the repetition, the safe writing. Maybe there, I don't know. So maybe it just hasn't been invented yet. Somebody once said about sociology, the sociology was a field that was waiting for its Einstein. You know, maybe writing.
I'm betting now that after listening to you that I'm going to be able to finish my second Virginia Templeton book, because what you said is really true. Just do it. And that's what I'm going to do. Just do it. Right. I'm
great.
Just do it.
Just sit down and do it. And especially if you bring Catherine in.
Yes.
You know, you've got to automatically try. Now, if you think about it, what's the core story in Virginia?
Her husband dies, she has to replace, so it's a king
replacement story, you see? The core story is there. Now, that doesn't mean that it can't be inventive and new, but just deep down in the ritual structure, it is, you know, it is a limited story that we have heard before, but the way you tell it is what gives us the inventiveness. So, and
well,
that's not a character like that, you know, with her,
mm-hmm. she can do anything, though. See, that's the thing. When you have a character like that, you are so open because nothing surprises you. Nothing surprises you. It's when you have a character that's so tight that you go like, oh, will they do this? But if you really let this Virginia go, and right, Catherine, that's the next thing for me, to let Catherine maybe go because she's so tight.
Yeah.
You know,
one of the things that bothers me also is one of the dicta in writing is your characters have to be consistent, and yet, you know, no human being is consistent. If they're consistent, it's called OCD, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder, you know. And so what do we have there? We've got a conflict between the maxim in writing, your characters have to be consistent, and the desire to write realistically in which characters are not consistent. So what do you do, you see?
Yes.
Well, with Virginia, she can become anything she wants.
I know. That's the good thing about her. I know. That's the fun of it. That's the fun of writing a character like that. Will you come on again? Because this is so, you're so interesting. I mean, you really are. I mean, I've been doing this for years, but there's nobody that speaks writing like you do, because you just say it like it is.
Look, I'll tell you, I think you really need to talk to Bob and to Sarah Martinez.
Yeah, I want to get both of them.
Are we about out of time, Marcia?
I just don't want to keep you. No, I have more time, but you know, I think you're probably, you know, you've been on for a while. You might not want to be on, but we could listen to you all day.
Of course, you know, I love to talk about writing. That's the one thing I don't mind about.
That's why I love
having
you on.
Author.
So, and I think the interesting part is that, like, because I said you just talk about whatever you want. Because I mean, I've been there, done that. So it's like there's not all these subjects, you know, I have done. And I think a lot of writers, they don't realize that you have to go through a lot of these things before you get in.
Oh, the hell of being a writer.
Yes.
You know, yeah, that's true.
What's as fun is we all love it, otherwise we wouldn't do it.
All right, well, we'll get together. So are we running out of time? You know,
well,
do you need
you
to go?
To
do I need to go?
You don't have to get. Do you want to talk about something else? I mean, I could. What do you want to talk about? Anything. You know, do you have a subject you want to discuss? I mean, you know.
Well, one of the things that I have really been focusing on lately is the rewrite. All right, I hear so much conflict among writers about, well, I never rewrite, or you know, I only do. I heard an interview with Les Edgerton, who is a fairly well-known novelist, short story writer, and he's a teacher. And in the interview, he said I never rewrite now. I tell my students to rewrite, but I don't rewrite. He said, on the other hand, when I first started writing, I rewrote all the time so that I gained the discipline of knowing how to put something together so that I spend less time on the nonsense and more time on what I really need to write. So what he's saying is the art is still in the rewrite. The rewrite becomes the way that you separate, you know, the good from the bad, the story from the non-story. In other words, in the rewrite, you learn how to cut out what is not essential, leaving only what is essential. Now, when Elmore Leonard in his 10 tips for writing, he says, leave out the stuff that readers tend to skip. Now,
right.
That is about as profound a thing
that's
as
right.
I've ever heard
about
writing.
No, that's true, I'm one of those people because I do skip a lot of things like that. I skip when it's not, I feel like, oh, there's so much description, who cares, just move on. And, you know, that's for me. But you're right, that's part, I never really, you know, think about that, but it is true. It's the parts that people might, you know,
might skip. He says, chances are you won't skip dialogue. And I think about it, I think, you know, that's and why? Why don't I skip dialogue? Because the good writer is it's in the dialogue that the good writer gives me the character.
Yeah.
You know, the story, you know, I'm kind of jaded here. You know, there are a limited number of stories, and I know from the first setup what it's going to be. So I really want to know about the character, so I don't skip the dialogue. Which
right.
is, you know.
I think that's
right
true. I would agree to that very much, yeah.
Mm-hmm. See, if you look at a movie, you know, the only thing, you see the action that the writer in the novel has to describe. You know, he opens the door and gets out of the car. Well, in the movie, that's an image.
Right.
You know, and behind every image, there are words. And once we understand when we look at a movie, we are looking at the end product of some writer saying he opens the door and gets out of the car, but we see it instead of reading it. You know, well, you discover those kinds of things in the rewrite. You know, so the art to me is in the rewrite, and I can talk for hours about approaches
so
to rewrite,
you
how you
say
go
your
about
blog?
It.
Do you want to say your blog? Because, you know, I've been telling people about your blog and everything because that's where you have a lot of things posted that will help them get through some of their problems.
Absolutely. It's called Bob and Jack's Writing Blog. When we got that title, we wanted the simplest, most direct thing. You know, so, okay, this is where Bob and Jack talk about writing.
Wow,
it's
that's great.
Bob
right.
and Jack's Writing Blog. And we get guest writers on there who come and post elements of their expertise. We did Joanne. We did a screenwriter. We did a memoirist. We did the latest one is middle grade novels for kids by Danica Densmore. So we try to foster a whole community of writing on that blog, not just with our own stuff, but pulling from the writing community as a whole. So there are all kinds of things. We have one on paranormal. We have one on kids' books. We have screenwriting. We have memoir, you know, so it's a good place. There are courses
because
in writing
write,
that we put up
there. There's so many different writers out there, and sometimes they write in the same, you know, in different genres, sometimes they don't, but, you know, and I'm definitely going to have you on. I am going to have Bob on because I think that we'll talk to him about other things, but you know, anytime that you ever want to talk about any subject, I'm ready to go because I think that these are so interesting and, you know, it was really, people were in the chat room, and I think that the people that were in the chat room, I've talked to you about, I always talk about you because I think that it's so helpful to me as a writer. And Joanne feels the same way. So, you know, so I want to thank you so much for being on today. And J.D., thank you for coming on. And J.D. has her show tomorrow.
Thank you very much for being there. You know, my world is women, believe it or not. You know, I write books about women, and women drive it, and my readers are women, and you know, I love y'all. I think it's really
great. That's good. that's a good thing. We like that. And
okay.
Bennett has
well,
I think Bennett has a show on Ashley's with Ashley Fontaine on her. She's has her show at 10 o'clock tonight Eastern and 9 o'clock Central. And
very
so,
good. Very good.
It's gonna. All these shows really help people. I think they do. I mean,
I hope
thing.
So. Okay, I will chat with
you
later.
So
and JD, thank you very much.
Bye,
and thanks to all the people
bye-bye.
In the chat room.
Thank
bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, and so that's
bye.
It. Wasn't that interesting?
Bye, Marcia.
That was interesting.
That was wonderful.
It was. I told you it was very good. Okay, everybody listening, we're going to have him on again because he's really, he's nonstop because it's so, he's got so much knowledge, it's unbelievable. He just, and all subjects. Well, he does all the genres. Thank you all for listening, and JD, have a good show tomorrow.
Okay, thank you, Marcia.
All right, and
have a good
goodbye
evening
to everybody, and Virginia shows Monday. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.